Welcome back to another episode of Under the Ginkgo Tree, a project of the Degnan Institute for Earth and Spirit here at Iona University. We are so glad that you have connected with us, that you have found us, that you are here and joining us for this journey of connecting with our earth, of connecting with each other, of just trying to draw near to one another. And so welcome back, and please stay here with us. On this episode, we will share with you an interview with Jordan Jones. We will also invite you into joining us for a loving kindness meditation. And we'll begin the episode by naming a location on campus. Okay, Jim, so what species have we identified for the podcast today?
So today we're talking about the honey locust trees on campus. We just walked past the honey locust trees on our way to this space. These trees, as you walk onto campus through the front gate, these trees form rows. And when the trees are in full bloom, there's this beautiful canopy overhead. I was talking to one of our colleagues, Elena Precario Foley, in the Religious Studies Department, and she remembers a time when these trees weren't on campus. Mm. So they were added relatively recently, maybe in the last 20 or 30 years, something like that. They grow very rapidly. So if you were to look at these trees, it would be hard to imagine them not being where they are. They almost seem like permanent fixtures to the campus. The tree itself gets its name honey locust because their seed pods contain this sweet pulp, which is edible. Native Americans have used this pulp as a food item as well as a medicinal item in a number of contexts. I should mention that the tree itself is native to North America, so it's quite different from the ginkgo tree in that regard. But it's much like the ginkgo tree. It has spread throughout the world. Yeah. It does really well in a range of contexts, like the ginkgo. Also like the ginkgo, its leaves turn from this green color to this really kind of golden, yellow, vibrant color in the fall, kind of right before they drop to the ground. They're very small leaves, which is one of the reasons why they're planted in cities, because from almost like an urban design standpoint, the small leaves will not clog up gutters and things like that. They're beautiful trees, and I think maybe we can contemplate what lessons we can take from these trees.
Yeah, I'm thinking about the way that humans learn and imitate and mimic nature, and specifically, how can we think about this tree? Just as you mentioned, right? So if people haven't been on Iona's campus, when they're in full bloom, they're beautiful, and they're right at the entranceway, and they grow kind of on each side on the road that comes into campus. And so I'm thinking about when they're in full bloom, these trees really create an arch, right? When the leaves are in full bloom, like the way that the branches come into each other on each side, right? Maybe they're like 10, 20 feet apart on each side of the road. But it's kind of like an arch over the road, right? Like this, if you stand back and kind of look into it, they're kind of in a line providing this beautiful, like almost cover, protective cover to that like roadway, whoever might be going through that.
Yeah.
There's many like human made arches, right? And I think there's also, we see these arches in nature, right? Like how do trees create arches? Yeah, just the beauty of that and seeing that when it's there.
Yeah, and I'm just struck by the capacity for this tree to thrive in so many contexts. Yeah. Like what does it mean to be that capable of adaptation? Right. You know, and what kinds of lessons can we take from that in our own lives as we move into different spaces to be capable of harmonizing with a variety of spaces and places?
Yeah, yeah. When I think of that, I also think about this, you know, there's this phrase that's often repeated, grow where you're planted. And I don't fully resonate with that. And when I think about these trees, right, like they didn't choose to grow there.
Yeah.
Right. And those were planted there by the architects and the, you know, the planners here at Iona to, you know, partially because of what you've said, like they can thrive there.
Sure.
Right. But still, like that wasn't like by nature's design. That wasn't kind of the tree's choice to grow there. And so I think about also like, what could it mean to like thrive and to grow well in a place where you haven't chosen to be? And I see those trees in some ways as an example of that, right? They didn't like end up there by natural process, but they're thriving. It's really a joy to welcome Jordan Jones onto this podcast. The two of us sat down and had a wonderful conversation recently here on campus. That was also on the same day that he spoke to Jim's classes and my classes, and he gave some wonderful, he led some wonderful conversations with our students on Howard Thurman and Harriet Tubman. And I'm just excited that we can share in this conversation here on the podcast a little bit about Jordan. The two of us met at Union Theological Seminary, where Jordan is finishing up his third year pursuing his Master's of Divinity. Jordan also works at a church in East Harlem called Metro Hope Church, where he preaches there. Metro Hope, the mission, the statement is kind of serving those who serve the world. And so I see kind of Jordan living into that mission at Metro. Prior to moving to New York, Jordan lived in Columbia, where he worked in human rights, journalism, and education. And it was also in Latin America that he began to learn about theology as a tool for liberation. Jordan's a proud alum of Morehouse College, where he double majored in English and Spanish. And in his free time, you can probably find Jordan dancing salsa, running, or catching a live jazz show in the city. And so without further ado, here is our conversation together. Great. Well, thanks, Jordan, for being here on campus. Thanks for coming to Iona, and thanks for sitting here with me in conversation.
It's an honor to be here. Yeah, thanks for having me again.
Yeah, of course. Mm-hmm. So just to jump right into things, I just thought I just wanted to start by asking you a little bit about your own journey, your own story, and what has drawn you into Howard Thurman and his own spirituality.
Mm. Yeah, thank you. So I first came to Howard Thurman through King, like many people. Dr. King, there's a kind of mythology around Martin Luther King that the book that he always carried with him was a book by Howard Thurman called Jesus and the Disinherited. And I was about 15. I was living in Atlanta. I grew up in Atlanta and was looking at kind of prospects for where to go to undergrad, and Morehouse was on the horizon because it was a historically black college that had produced figures like King. And I came across this book, Jesus the Disinherited, and was just enamored by the way that he wrote about kind of matters of the heart and also matters of justice. And I also love language. You know, I studied English and Spanish in undergrad and was drawn to literature. And I was always intrigued by the kind of the spiritual conversation behind a lot of social justice leaders. And that took me to journalism, and then it took me kind of roundabout way to South America. I lived in Colombia for some time, for about 4.5 years. And I kept running into leaders, human rights leaders, both in person and on paper, who had cultivated a strong sense of an interior life. And so that is where Thurman, I'm always in conversation with Thurman about what does it mean to live inwardly. And that animates me today. As you know, I'm kind of finishing up a degree at Union Theological Seminary, and I'm also supporting a congregation in New York City. And I've had the opportunity to preach and be on staff there and also support some of their work in the community. And so, you know, Thurman's always coming back, and I don't think we talk about him enough. But he's someone that I feel like is always kind of looming in the background.
Well, I'm glad for the way that you kind of always are talking about Thurman and bringing him into the foreground, right? And I've heard a few times the way that you kind of reshare his own meditation on centering down and how you've done that at Metro Hope Church. And I wonder if you could speak just a bit about that meditation in particular and how it's tied. Like, you talked about how Thurman provides this strong sense of an inner life, right? And so could you talk more about, yeah, how has Thurman kind of helped you to cultivate your inner life? And how has that, you know, meditation on centering down kind of been influential for you?
Yeah. Could I read a portion of it? I've got it up right here.
Yeah, please do.
And so it starts, you know, how good it is to center down. And that is a phrase that, you know, Thurman studied under Rufus Jones and George Fox. These were the kind of the foundational leaders of the Quakers. And so he uses like Quaker language throughout his work, even though he grew up in a Christian household from the South. But he asked these questions in the meditation. It says that the questions persist. What are we doing with our lives? What are the motives that order our days? What is the end of our doings? Where are we trying to go? Where do we put the emphasis? And where are our values focused? For what end do we make sacrifices? Where is my treasure? And what do I love most in life? What do I hate most in life? And to what am I true? Over and over, the questions beat upon the waiting moment. As we listen, floating up through all the jangling echoes of our turbulence, there was a sound of another kind. A deeper note which only the stillness of the heart makes clear. It moves directly to the core of our being. Our questions are answered, our spirits refreshed, and we move back into the traffic of our daily round with the peace of the eternal in our step. How good it is to center down. And so it's really those questions that I try to bring into the space, because these are questions that animate every single human being's who's ever existed in life, right? What are the motives of our day? What are the ends of our doings? Where are we trying to go?
Yeah.
I'd say, irrespective of class, of race, ethnicity, political structure, these are questions that animate everybody. And so it brings it down to this very moment. And so the larger meditation, you know, you get Thurman standing at a street corner, basically, and he talks about the cars coming and going and like life happening before him. And so I really resonate with that. And being able to center down is allowing to make the space wherever you are to be able to listen to that still small voice that we all have. And then I think what makes Thurman unique and what puts him in a lineage of Black mystics is that question is not only individual, right? So the experiencing of center down is a deeply individual one, but it also connects you to a community, and it connects you to a people, and it connects you to structures and conditions, right? And so Thurman is really masterful, because a lot of his language seems soft, but his grandmother who raised him was an enslaved woman. Right, so she understood the dehumanizing structures of enslavement. Thurman himself grew up under Jim Crow, and so these things were very real to him. And so as he's standing on the street corner, he's also seeing segregated train cars, and he's seeing Black men bow their heads on the sidewalk, and he's seeing, you know, the news of Emmett Till's death and murder. And so he says, "Well, okay, how can you know, these structures, if I had a magic wand and change it, I would do it, but it's maybe not that simple. Maybe that work is actually internal first." And so that's why I really resonate with Thurman and try to bring him into a lot of the work that I do.
And I love to just think about Thurman standing there on that street corner, and to that is almost like that's where his centering down comes from. If you can speak more on like how important it is to have that inner sense of grounding and to be defined by what it means to be centered down from within, right? And to, you know, let those questions guide you from your inner sense of self. That inner sense of self, as you said, is not separate from the world, you know, but it's not, you don't let your sense of self be defined by the world.
Exactly.
Right? So.
Exactly. I mean, one of the things that Thurman's grandmother taught him, and I think that in order to, when you're reading Howard Thurman, you're really reading his grandmother through him, because she was someone that was illiterate. She was someone that was not learned in a conventional sense, but she had these like organic sensibilities around spirituality and her understanding of self. And she has this anecdote that's written in Jesus the Disinherited that there was a preacher, a black preacher that, you know, on the few Sundays that he got a chance to preach, he would tell them, he said, "You are not slaves. You are children of God." And it's such a striking refusal of the systems that tell us that we are everything but a child of God.
Yeah.
And so what centering down does is it allows you the space to tap into that, right? And there's, you know, like that is the kind of fertile ground for the conversation to be reminded of, like, okay, well, who am I? You know, like, and then how is who I am influenced? How does that influence where are we going? And what are the motives of my day? And what do I love most? And what do I hate most? I find that it's actually in that space where you can kind of come go into self and then come up into the other.
Mm.
Right. And so as I sit here, if I am tapped into my child of godness, then I'm also able to tap into your child of godness. And I'm also able to look outside and see this tree and see that the tree is also imbued with the fingerprints of God. And so then it actually gets kind of entangled, you know? And so then the work of being in tune with myself is now being in tune with everything that I'm a part of, you know?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I hear you now kind of echoing a little bit of the sound of the genuine.
Absolutely.
Touching the genuine in yourself. Then you can and speak and touch the genuine in others.
Yeah. In Thurman's 1982, he gave a speech at the baccalaureate ceremony at Spelman College. And in it, it's a beautiful, beautiful work. I think if anyone's trying to get into Thurman, I would say read The Sound of the Genuine, his speech. But he says, you know, ask not what the world needs, ask what makes you come alive and go do that. Because what the world needs is people who've come alive.
Yeah.
And that's such a different orientation to the way that we think about social change now.
Right.
You know, I think we, well, you know, what do we need to do? And what's the line items? And what's like, how do you get the grant? And what are the objectives of the institution or the political platform? But Thurman says, actually, that's not it. Actually, what it is we need people who have come alive, you know? And if we go through that door, then that connection will be made almost organically.
Yeah, that organic connection is so beautiful, right? And I'm even thinking that often there's a famous quote that's often made into a Venn diagram about what are your gifts and what does the world need and how do you connect that? But even that somehow misses, like, what makes you come alive, right? That is almost more in touch with, you know, what is making you alive? What is your spiritual aliveness? Mm. What is the God in you, right?
Mm.
And then how is that... you know, how is that guiding you forward?
Yeah.
Right. And that's a little bit different than, like you said, the way that we think about, you know, social change.
King echoes those words when he talks about the street sweeper, you know, and he talks about, you know, if you were born to be a street sweeper, then sweep those streets.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because I think that the Venn diagram still makes us the protagonist and it still makes us seem like it's our gifts that are going to change. But I think about, you know, a professor of mine, Dr. Cornel West, says, you know, it's a way to be, you know, it's just a way to be in the world. And so if you're cleaning streets or if you're, you know, doing housework, if you're raising a family, if you're in academia or if you're, you know, gardening or farming, you know, or what have you,
right.
You know, how can you do that from a sense of like authentically understanding who you are in relationship to the divine?
And perhaps those are kind of the notes that you're playing, right? Mm. That's what you're kind of adding to the symphony, right, at that time.
Yes.
Or thinking about Dr. West, like, that's the jazz, right? That's your moment to solo, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I know we both love jazz as you're a musician, but, you know, you watch the like, very delicate balance of a you know, you have the band leader and then you have the soloist or whoever is taking on that solo. And like, there's the grace to allow somebody to try to figure it out, you know, but it's always in service of the full piece.
That's right.
You know, and so, and then sometimes you do see the maybe if the soloist is not in that in touch with the band, they'll kind of like try to hog the spotlight, mm-hmm. you know, and like mm-hmm. you can see the band leader's like, all right, like, you know, it's yeah. time for us to get back into it.
Yeah.
But it's a really beautiful like harmony when yeah. we're each allowed to like share in our gifts in service of the full piece.
Right. You know? Yeah. I mean, thinking, you know, to go further on that, sometimes the best soloists aren't the most, you know, technically, you know, proficient, mm-hmm. but they're in sync. They're sitting in the rhythm, in the groove, and they're, you know, allowing it to come forth. Right.
Yeah.
I also want to ask you, so today you're on campus, you're yeah. going to be talking about Howard Thurman, but you're also going to bring Harriet Tubman into mm. the conversation.
Yeah.
And so you posed the question really well, kind of in our description for today. What can Howard Thurman and Harriet Tubman teach us about spirituality in the fight for justice today? So I wonder just if you can speak a little bit more about how are you bringing Harriet Tubman into this conversation?
Yeah, no, I love that question. And I'm very much in a kind of headspace thinking about Harriet Tubman right now. And it's a little bit of a slingshot because I think that we go from mysticism. And some of the critiques around Thurman is that Thurman wasn't as actively in the streets as King was, mm-hmm. right? Thurman was King Sr. And though Thurman was, you know, was one of the first black delegations to meet Gandhi, his space was more from the pulpit and from academia, you know, right. And so he was tinkering away in his office while people were in the streets. And that's something that he wrestled with himself. But then you take a figure like Harriet Tubman, you know, who obviously precedes him. And she was born in 1822 and died in 1913. So there was a period of time wow. where they were alive at the same time, yeah. you know, which is baffling to think yeah. about, you know. But when I think about Tubman, I think about like utmost activation, like kinetic energy, right? She's on the move. Mm. She is someone that is an actor through and through, mm. right? She made 13 trips back and forth across territories of enslavement to freedom to free over 80 people, 80 human beings that were yeah. under the condition of slavery. And so I'm thinking, well, if our contemporary understanding of a mystic is like, you know, sitting in the woods meditating, which is important,
right.
how does that connect with the being in the woods as a fugitive, mm. right, escaping from enslavement? And so I was thinking that maybe there's something about the mystical journey that Tubman was tapping into that actually allowed, that gave her the motivation, the fuel to make those, what they call trips of mercy. Mm. And so, you know, thinking about Tubman's sensibility and understanding of ecology, of the wilderness, and also thinking about her own spiritual orientation, right? She was a deeply spiritual person. She was a professed Christian and like, would speak out loud to God and was animated by her understanding that it was God's will that she would be free. I feel like she's in conversation with Thurman, mm. right? And there's a quote, if I can share this quote from Thurman, that he gave in a lecture at Lawrence, I think Lawrence College in 1978, and it says, "To live under siege with the equilibrium and tranquility of inner peace, to prevent the springs of my being from being polluted by the bitter waters that flow as drainage from the tablelands of violence and hatred. To do these two things, in even the most limited and circumscribed way, is to be strong enough to carry the heavy stones of the spirit, which are necessary for the foundations of the kingdom of friendly men underneath a friendly sky." Mm-hmm. So you get that soft language with friendly, right? But what Thurman is talking about with these heavy stones is the heavy stones of a liberated society. And so the two kind of conditions that he says to live under siege, what does it mean to live under siege?
Yeah.
I would say enslavement is a kind of utmost condition of being under siege.
Yeah.
With the equilibrium and tranquility of inner peace. So that's the mystical bit, right? So you refuse the conditions of being under siege. So Tubman, who's born Araminta Ross, nicknamed Minty, mm-hmm. 3 years before she made her first trip to Philadelphia, she changed her name to Harriet. So she already had a sensibility of refusal, right? She was already tinkering with this idea yeah. of her of self and who she was in relationship to the divine. And then it says, to prevent the springs of my being from being polluted by the bitter waters. And so that, again, is to not like accept the vestiges or the condition of a dehumanizing structure. So that's where I'm putting those two in conversation, you know. And I think, especially at least in my own imagination, I've thought about, well, what would I have done had I been under the condition of slavery? Like, I've gone immediately. I would have not, I wouldn't take anything. But it's much more complicated when you realize what people had to risk in order to leave the plantation. Dehumanizing and dangerous was the condition of slavery, it was also a certainty. It was also a kind of way of life that people got accustomed to. Mm. It was also a guaranteed meal, not a good meal. Mm-hmm. It was guaranteed structure, not good structure, right? Like abject, kind of inhumane condition, but still there was certainty there.
Yeah.
And so, what was the work that had to happen to get people to wake up out of that? And then even on the trip, people still wouldn't go back. It's like, okay, this freedom is too much for me to bear.
Mm. I mean, I'm just struck by the inner sense, right, of both of them, of their own freedom, right? And then how to act with that sense and that belief mm-hmm. to be a child of God and that moving forward, right? And that taking community with you, right? That they both, like, do throughout their lives, right?
And that's a bit that I'd love to, I'm so glad you highlighted, because we can often pluck out certain figures as if they're protagonists or heroes. Part of the mystic, and it's somewhat counterintuitive, is in community. And they're building their capacity to be in community together. And so in order to tap into the understanding and I want to resist the word of empathy, but to understand, to be able to see the other, you have to be able to see yourself in relationship to the other.
Yeah.
And so there is this kind of, you go up on the mountain as Jesus did many a times and then came back down.
Yeah.
Right. So that you can become a better community member.
Yeah. I'm also reminded of the work of Trisha Hersey mm-hmm. and what she does with Rest is Resistance with the Nat ministry. Right. And just this, insistent that, it's our divine right to rest, mm-hmm. right? And just to say that, period, and it's not further than that, right? It's our divine right to rest now because of the systems of exploitation kind of that are upon us.
Thinking about, what does it mean to be under siege now?
Right.
Right? And so, I am interested in these figures in their own right, but I'm wondering, what do they have to say about the moment that we're in now?
Yeah.
What conditions in 100 years will people look upon and say, they just sat down and yes. took it? They just stayed there while there was, genocide happening, while there right. was, people were starving. I'm hoping that in 100 or 200 years, people have a sense to, a sensibility to, care for all beings. They just sat by and allowed the planet
Yeah.
to just be destroyed and exploited.
Yeah.
Right? Like, if I was there, what I would have done is X, Y, Z, X, Y, Z.
Right.
And so there is a kind of awakening also that Tubman is inviting us into, to see these systems as impossible.
Yeah.
To see the systems of enslavement, to see the systems of fascism, of neoliberalism, of capitalism, right? Like, all of these systems that are keeping us content with the conditions that we're in.
That's right.
Right. And we all are not in the same conditions either. Right. But I think that what the mystic offers is like, okay, if I go down into myself and come up into the houseless person, then my future is now bound up with this person.
Yeah.
Because that is also a child of God. And so as long as this person is unhoused, or this person is hungry, or this person that cannot get the care that they need, or a quality of presence, even, within your own home, then it becomes a kind of greater project.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
There's so much there that we could unpack, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, what could these teachers share with us? How could they guide us today, right? One thing that I'm drawn to ask you what you would ponder is just, I'm thinking about the land, right? And you mentioned it, and we were talking earlier about, Harriet Tubman's relationship with the land a little bit.
Mm.
And Howard Thurman, in his childhood and throughout his life, had a relationship with the land. You know, what lessons could we take from both Harriet Tubman or Howard Thurman in considering this moment we're in right now with the land, the suffering of our earth?
Yeah, it's such a good question. You know, I think with Tubman in particular, the land was it was her relationship with the wilderness, right? And the wilderness, I mean, you know, from biblical stories on to now, was a place of danger, right? But it was also the place of refuge. And so Tubman had a deferential relationship with the wilderness, and the land that she was occupied was previously inhabited by the Algonquin and the Iroquois and the Powhatan people, until it was stolen. And so there were sensibilities that Tubman had to be able to convene with the divine through what was at her fingertips, right? And so I think it's an invitation into seeing God in all things, right? In all of God's creation. And so that is, you know, what Thurman talks about when he sits at the, I think he talks about watching the ocean or sitting by this oak tree that he grew up looking at and thinking that, you know, God was speaking to him through it. You know, I think that as particularly as we think about mysticism, it is not always, you know, the quality or the concern of the mystic is not to hear God speak, but it's to listen to God. And so I think what the land teaches us and gives us is probably no better container for that listening.
Yeah.
Right? Whether you're in a city and you can behold a tree, or whether you're out in the forest, right? Like, you know, are you tuned in to the messages of nature, to the economy of nature, to the ways that the way that nature communicates? And is there something of the divine in that? You know, and it takes some stillness, right? Like, you can watch as much Planet Earth, or you can read as many ecology textbooks, but have you really sat and, like, listened to a tree?
Yeah.
You know? And you're like, oh, why would I do that? It doesn't say anything. Well, maybe that's a lesson too.
Right, you know? Right, absolutely.
Maybe that's a lesson too.
Yeah.
And so it's being able to behold nature as the fingerprint of the vestiges of God's creation, and to lean into it and to listen to it. And the thing that may scare you may also be the thing that is where we can take refuge.
Yeah.
And I think we see that through all experiences. I mean, the Buddha found refuge in nature. You know, Moses' conversation with the burning bush, you know, that prompted this, like, encounter, right? It was Jesus in Gethsemane, and Jesus on the mountaintop, and Jesus in the ocean. You know, it's Tubman on the swamp, and Tubman on the boat, and it's a respect and a orientation towards the unknown, but also a trust that there's something good about the land. You know, that there's something to be treasured and learned from in the land.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and just for so many of us, right, I think it's like, it's simple, but it's also like profound call to pay attention, right? Because just in our days, right, we walk by, you know, a tree every day that we've never paid attention to, right? And it's like, oh, there's no need to pay attention to it, right? But just like what you're saying, what would it mean to be deeply attuned to what's right around us? You know, in and of itself, just to be attuned to that, you know, has value. But then also, like, being attuned to that, like, what would a relationship with the tree, what would seeing the genuine in that tree lead us to, like, respond in terms of how we're seeing, you know, the earth kind of be, like, you know, defiled and be, like, you know, like, really, like, tortured in a sense in this, like, climate we're living in.
It's interesting you say that, because, and I think Tubman's words were, she called these her trips the trips of mercy. You know, I love that concept. But she would strategically plan her trips of mercy in the wintertime. And I'm still learning about why she did that. But she had a sense of the seasons, right? And she had a sense of listening to the earth. And I think that's just such a beautiful kind of lesson of attunement.
As we're closing up, I have one final question for you. I just want to ask if you could share three things: a book, a ritual or a prayer, and then a plant that have been giving you life, sustenance, that have just been accompanying you lately in your own journey.
Okay, that's a great question. So the first is a book. because we're talking about Harriet Tubman, I have to recommend Night Flyer by Taya Miles. A look at her spirituality and her ecological sensibility. It's a really wonderful book that just came out last year called Night Flyer. The second one was A Ritual.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, well, one thing that I've been thinking about, it's like a slight shift in thinking, is that, and a mantra that I've been having is life is a dance, not a race.
Mm.
And it's allowed me to see moments in my day and encounters that I have as not moments to be won, but moments to be experienced. And so I've tried to take on this practice of seeing life as a kind of a delicate dance, you know? And so yeah. I start the morning with silence, and I start it with Meditations of the Heart by Thurman, you know? And it's through that kind of configuration of what makes you come alive, you know? And I love running, but I also love dancing,
yeah.
you know? And I love running because I don't trace my progress. I just enjoy doing it. And so
yeah.
how could I see life like that?
I love that. Life is a dance, not a race.
Yeah. And then lastly,
a plant, ooh. A tree.
I was recently involved in a ritual with a dear friend, and we were looking at amaranth. And amaranth was actually the name that Araminta Ross, which was Harriet Tubman's given name, she was named after this plant, amaranth.
Wow.
And it's a remarkable grain, and it's got beautiful kind of like luminous foliage, but actually the seed is high in protein, high in calcium, and it's a very resilient seed, and it stores water. It thrives in the winter because the frost has to kill off the leaves so that you can harvest it.
Wow.
And amaranth is just like an incredible teacher, if you can find some and eat some or drink some of its tea. So I'd say
beautiful.
Night Flyer, I'd say Life is a Dance, and I'd say get your hands on some amaranth.
So this is a version of a traditional Buddhist meditation practice called metta, loving kindness. And the goal of this practice is to cultivate compassion while also deepening our sense of our place in the wider web of life. And so as we move through this practice, I invite you to begin by closing your eyes and just getting comfortable, seeing if you're holding any tension in your body and just letting that tension go. Maybe you can put your feet flat on the floor and just bring your attention to your breath and try to breathe in a little bit more deeply than you typically do. And so we'll begin this practice by calling to mind somebody who it's easy to feel loving kindness for, somebody that we're close to and that we care about deeply without even having to try. And as we call this person to mind, we repeat these phrases. And really the goal of repeating these phrases is to actually feel the feeling behind them. May you be at peace. May you be deeply grateful. May you sense your interdependence with the wider web of life. May you be at peace. May you be deeply grateful. May you sense your interdependence with the wider web of life. We can just kind of sit with the feeling that comes up for us. Maybe we feel an expansion. Maybe we feel a warmth in our hearts. Next, we want to just call to mind somebody who's kind of a neutral presence in our lives. Maybe we pass them on our commutes occasionally. Maybe they're a cashier. there's somebody that we recognize but don't have a deep feeling about, either positive or negative. And we call that person to mind, and we try to cultivate the same feelings toward that person. May you be at peace. May you be deeply grateful. May you sense your interdependence with the wider web of life. May you be at peace. May you be deeply grateful. May you sense your interdependence with the wider web of life. So now we want to call to mind a more than human being, maybe a plant, maybe an animal, a being beyond our species. And we call this being to mind. Maybe we're very familiar with them. Maybe it's a pet that we live with, or maybe it's a tree that we pass occasionally. We call this being to mind, and we offer these same sentiments. May you be at peace. May you be deeply grateful. May you sense your interdependence with the wider web of life. May you be at peace. May you be deeply grateful. May you sense your interdependence with the wider web of life. And now we call to mind somebody who it's difficult for us to love. Somebody who we push out of our hearts. And we try to cultivate these intentions of compassion, even for this person. May you be at peace. May you be deeply grateful. May you sense your interdependence with the wider web of life. May you be at peace. May you be deeply grateful. May you sense your interdependence with the wider web of life. And now we want to intentionally bring ourselves into this field of compassion and care, extending these intentions to our own bodies, our own minds, our own lives, as we repeat to ourselves, may I be at peace. May I be deeply grateful. May I sense my interdependence with the wider web of life. May I be at peace. May I be deeply grateful. May I sense my interdependence with the wider web of life. And the traditional way of closing this prayer is to offer this loving kindness to all sentient beings, to all living beings, perhaps throughout the universe itself. And so we just expand even further our hearts, the spaciousness of our compassion and our care, as we, in closing, offer these intentions to all living beings. May you be at peace. May you be deeply grateful. And may you sense your interdependence with the wider web of life. So thank you so much, everybody, for joining us for this episode of the podcast, and we hope to see you next time.
thanks again to all of our supporters. We're thankful for the Yale Forum for Religion and Ecology, to the Degnan Institute for Earth and Spirit, to Gracchus, who is helping to amplify and to share and support this message, and of course to all of our listeners, to you for deciding to put this in your earphones, in your laptops, and to give us a listen.
Yeah, and thanks again to Jordan for joining us on campus, for his friendship with you, Liam, and for this conversation.